Catherine had on her black wool crepe suit, her funeral suit, and she resembled, she thought, more a businesswoman than a schoolteacher. A lawyer, possibly, headed to London for a deposition. She wore her hair in a loose twist, and she had on pearl earrings. She had her leather gloves in one hand and a black chenille scarf around her neck. She thought she looked rather good under the circumstances, certainly more put together than she had in weeks. But she had lost weight in her face and knew she looked older than she had 12 days ago. That morning, after she had told Robert about her proposed trip to London, she had driven over to Julia's to tell Maddie of her plans. Maddie had been painfully indifferent to Catherine's trip. Her only lucid comment, amid sighs and a muffled groan of exasperation, had been a dismissive, "Whatever." "I'm only going for 2 days," Catherine had said. "Cool," Maddie had said. "Can I go back to bed now?" In the kitchen, Julia had tried to explain Maddie's seeming indifference. "She's 15, said Julia, who had been up for hours. She was dressed for her day in a pair of jeans with an elastic waist and a green sweatshirt. "She has to have someone to blame, so she's blaming you. I know it's irrational. You don't remember this, but for a time, right after your parents died, you blamed me." "I did not," Catherine said heatedly. "Yes, you did. You never said it outright, but I knew. And it passed. Like this, too, will pass." Right now, Maddie wants to blame her father. She's furious with him for leaving her, for upsetting her life in such a drastic way. But blaming him is out of the question. She's practically his only defender. Eventually, Maddie's anger will slide away from you and find its proper target. What you need to do is make sure the anger doesn't come about full circle so that she begins to blame herself for her father's death. "Then I should stay," Catherine said weakly. But Julia had been adamant that Catherine go. Privately, Catherine understood that Julia wanted to get her out of the house, not for her sake, but for Maddie's. As the widow of a pilot, Catherine was entitled to fly on a pass wherever vision went, in the first-class section, whenever seats were available. She gestured to Robert to take the window, and she stowed her luggage under the seat in front of her. Immediately, she became aware of the stale air inside the plane, with its distinctive, artificial smell. The door to the cockpit was open, and Catherine could see the crew. The size of the cockpit never failed to startle her. Many of them were smaller than the front seats of automobiles. She wondered how it was possible for the scenario suggested by the CVR on Jack's plane to have taken place. There seemed hardly room for 3 men to sit, let alone move around and have a scuffle. From her vantage point, she could see only the inner third of the cockpit, bits of each pilot in shirt sleeves. It was impossible, gazing at the tableau, the thickish arms, the confident gestures, not to imagine the man in the left-hand seat as Jack. She pictured the shape of his shoulder, the whiteness of his inner wrist. She had never been a passenger on an airliner Jack was flying. The captain rose and turned toward the cabin. His eyes found Catherine's, and she understood that he meant to express his sympathy. He was an older man with a fringe of gray hair and light brown eyes. He seemed almost too kindly to be in charge. He was hopeless with the condolences, and she liked him for his inarticulateness. She thanked him and even managed a slight smile. She said she was doing as well as could be expected under the circumstances, which was all anyone ever wanted to hear. He asked her if she would be traveling on to Malinhead to be with the other family members, and she answered quickly and perhaps too emphatically, "No." He seemed embarrassed for having asked. She turned then and introduced the captain to Robert Hart. The captain studied Robert as if he might be someone he had met before. Then the man excused himself, went back up to the cockpit, and locked the door behind him. For his safety, for their safety. The flight attendant collected the champagne glasses she'd brought around earlier, and Catherine saw to her surprise that she had drained hers. She couldn't remember drinking it, though she could taste it in her mouth. She looked at her watch, 8:14 in the evening. It would be 1:14 a.m. in London. The plane lumbered to the runway. The pilot, the captain with the washed-out eyes, revved the engines for the takeoff. Her heart stalled for one prolonged beat, then kicked painfully inside her chest. Her vision narrowed to a dot, the way the picture used to do when one turned off the TV. Catherine held the armrests and closed her eyes. She bit her lower lip. A veil of protective mist dissipated, and she saw all that was possible. Pieces of bulkhead flooring ripped from the cabin. A person, perhaps a child, harnessed into a seat, spinning through the open air. A fire beginning in a cargo hold and spreading into the cabin. The plane gathered speed with unnatural momentum. The staggeringly heavy mass of the T-900 would refuse to lift. She shut her eyes and began to pray the only prayer she could remember. Our Father. She had never before known fear on an airliner, even on the bumpiest transatlantic flights. Jack had always been relaxed on a plane, as both a pilot and a passenger, and his calm had seemed to seep into Catherine through a kind of marital osmosis. But that protection was gone now. If she had believed herself safe in an airplane because Jack had, didn't it follow that she could die in a plane if he had? She felt then the shame and revulsion of knowing she was going to be sick. Robert put his hand on her back. When the plane was airborne, Robert signaled to the flight attendant, who brought ice water and cold towels and a discreet paper bag. Catherine's body, unable to perceive relief in having made it aloft, rebelled. To her chagrin, she vomited up the champagne. She was amazed at how intensely visceral the fear of one's own death was. She hadn't been this sick, even when she'd learned that Jack had died. As soon as the seatbelt sign was turned off, Catherine rose unsteadily to use the lavatory. A flight attendant handed her a plastic envelope containing a toothbrush, toothpaste, a washcloth, a bar of soap, and a comb, and Catherine realized such kits were kept on hand expressly for physically distraught passengers. Were they for first-class passengers only, or did everyone get one? In the tiny lavatory, Catherine washed her face. Her slip and blouse were soaked with sweat, and she tried to dry the skin of her shoulders and neck with paper towels. The plane lurched, and she banged her head against a cabinet. She brushed her teeth as best she could and thought of all the times she'd felt condescending toward people who were afraid to fly. When she returned, Robert rose from his seat and took her arm. I can't explain, she said, sitting down and gesturing for him to do the same. I suppose it was fear. I was certain the plane wouldn't get off the ground and that we'd be going so fast we'd crash. He gently squeezed her arm. She pressed her seat back, and Robert aligned his seat with hers. Almost reluctantly, it seemed, he took a magazine from his briefcase. She fingered her wedding ring. Over the intercom, the captain spoke with a resonant voice that was meant to be reassuring, yet flight itself still felt wrong. The difficulty lay with the mind accommodating itself to the notion of the plane, with all its weight, defying gravity, staying aloft. She understood the aerodynamics of flight, could comprehend the laws of physics that made flight possible, but her heart at the moment would have none of it. Her heart knew the plane could fall out of the sky. When she woke, it was dark both inside and outside of the plane. Overhead, a washed-out movie played silently on a screen. They were flying toward morning. When Jack had died, he'd flown into darkness, as if he were outrunning the sun. Through the windows, she saw clouds. Over where, she wondered. Newfoundland? The Atlantic? Malinhead? She wondered if the heart stopped from the concussion of the bomb, or if it stopped at the moment of certain knowledge that one would die, or if it stopped in reaction to the horror of falling through the darkness, or if it did not stop until the body hit the water. What was it like to watch the cockpit split away from the cabin, and then to feel yourself still harnessed to your seat, falling through the night, knowing that you would hit the water at terminal velocity, as surely Jack would have known if he were conscious? Did he cry out Catherine's name, another woman's name? Was it Maddie's name he called in the end? Or had Jack, too, in the last desperate wail of his life, called out for his mother? She hoped her husband had not had to cry out any name, that he had not had a second to know he would die. Beside her in the taxi, Robert stretched his legs. The gold buttons on his blazer had set off the airport security alarm. He wore gray trousers, a white shirt, a black and gold paisley tie. He looked thinner than he had just yesterday. She raised a hand to her hair and tried to refasten a wisp. Between them, there were two overnight bags, both remarkably small. She had packed hastily without much thought. Her case contained a change of underwear and stockings, a different blouse. They entered London proper and began to pass through pleasant residential areas. The taxi pulled abruptly to a curb. Through the rain, Catherine saw a street of white stucco townhouses, an immaculate row of almost identical facades. The houses rose 4 stories tall and were graced with bow front windows. Delicate wrought iron fences bordered the sidewalk, and each house bore a lantern hanging from a columned portico. Only the front doors spoke of individuality. Some were thick wood-paneled doors, some had small glass panes, others were painted dark green. The houses closest to the taxi were identified with discreet numbers on small brass plaques. The house they'd parked in front of read number 21. Catherine sat back on the upholstered seat. "Not yet," she said. "Do you want me to go instead?" he asked. She thought about the offer and smoothed her skirt. Like the steady hum of the engine, the driver seemed unperturbed by the weight. "What would you do when you got there?" she asked. He shook his head as if to say he hadn't given it any thought, or that he would do what she asked him to. "What will you do?" he asked. Catherine felt lightheaded and thought she could no longer predict with any accuracy the actions and reactions of her body. The difficulty with not thinking about the immediate future, she decided, was that it left one unprepared for its reality. The drive to the hotel was brief, the block on which it stood eerily like the one they had just left. The hotel had taken over 7 or 8 townhouses and had a discreet entrance. The upper floors were ringed with pristine white balustrades. Robert had booked 2 adjacent but not adjoining rooms. He carried her bag to the door. "We'll have lunch downstairs in the pub," he said. He checked his watch. "At noon?" "Sure," she answered. "You don't have to do this," he said. Her room was small but perfectly adequate. The walls bore an innocuous wallpaper, brass wall sconces. There was a desk and a bed, a trouser press, an alcove where one could make a cup of coffee or tea. She showered, changed her underwear and blouse, and brushed her hair. Looking into the mirror, she put her hands to her face. She could no longer deny that something was waiting for her here in this city. Sometimes, she thought, courage was simply a matter of putting one foot in front of another and not stopping. The pub was dark with wood-paneled alcoves. Irish music played from overhead, prints of horses matted in dark green and framed in gold were hung upon the walls. A half dozen men sat at the bar, drinking large glasses of beer, and pairs of businessmen were seated in the alcoves. She spotted Robert across the room, comfortably slouched against a banquette cushion. He looked contented, perhaps more than contented. He waved to her. She crossed the room and lay her purse on the banquette. "I took the liberty of ordering you a drink," he said. She glanced at the ale. In front of Robert was a glass of mineral water. She slipped in next to him. Her feet brushed his, but it seemed rude to pull away. "What happened to you?" she asked suddenly, gesturing toward the water. "I mean with the drinking. I'm sorry, do you mind my asking?" "No," he said, shaking his head. "My parents were both professors at a college in Toronto. Every evening they held court for the students, a kind of salon. The tray with the bottles on it was always the focal point of the gathering. The students loved it, of course. I started joining them when I was 15. Actually, now that I think of it, my parents probably created a lot of alcoholics." "You're Canadian?" "Originally, not now." Catherine studied the man beside her. What did she know about him, except that he had been kind to her? He seemed good at his job, and he was undeniably attractive. She wondered if accompanying her to London was somehow part of his job description. "We might have come here for no good reason," she said, and could hear the note of hope in her voice. Like finding a suspicious lump in your breast, she thought, and then having the doctor tell you it was nothing, nothing at all. "Robert, I'm sorry," she said. "This is nuts. I know you must think I'm out of my mind. I'm really sorry to have dragged you into it." "I love London," he said quickly, seemingly unwilling to dismiss their joint venture so quickly. "You need to eat something," he said. "I hate Irish music. Why is it always so lugubrious?" She smiled. "Have you been here before?" she asked, acquiescing to the change in subject. "To this hotel?" "I come here fairly often," he said. "We liaise, I believe the word is, with our British counterparts." She studied the menu, laid it down on the polished but slightly sticky veneer of the table. "You have a beautiful face," he said suddenly. She blushed. No one had said that to her in a long time. She was embarrassed that she had colored, that he could see it mattered. She picked up the menu again and began to re-examine it. "I can't eat, Robert. I just can't." "There's something I want to tell you," he began. She held her hand up. She didn't want him to say anything that would require her to respond. "I'm sorry," he said, glancing away. "You don't need this." "I was just thinking about how enjoyable this is," she said quietly, and she saw with surprise that he couldn't hide his disappointment at the tepid offering. "I'm going to go now," she said. "I'll go with you." "No," she said. "I have to do this alone." He leaned over and kissed her cheek. "Be careful," he said. She went out onto the street blindly, moving now with a momentum she didn't dare to question. The taxi dropped her in front of the narrow townhouse she had seen little more than an hour before. She surveyed the street, studied a small pink lamp in a ground floor window. She paid the driver and was certain, as she stepped out onto the curb, that she had given the man too many coins. The rain poured over the edges of her umbrella and soaked the back of her legs, spotting and then running down her stockings. There was a moment as she stood on the steps in front of the imposing wooden door when she thought, "I don't have to do this." Though she understood in the same moment that it was knowing that she would positively do this that had allowed her the luxury of indecision. She raised the heavy brass knocker and rapped on the door. She heard footsteps on an inner staircase, the short, impatient cry of a child. The door opened abruptly, as though the person behind it were expecting a delivery. It was a woman, a tall, angular woman, with dark hair that fell along her jawline. The woman was 30, perhaps 35. She held a child on her hip, a child so astonishing that it was all Catherine could do not to cry out. Catherine began to tremble inside her coat. She held the umbrella at an unnatural angle. The woman with the child looked surprised and for a moment quizzical. And then she did not seem surprised at all. "I've been imagining this moment for years," the woman said. The features of the woman impressed themselves upon Catherine's consciousness, like acid eating away at a photographic plate. The brown eyes, the thick, dark lashes, the narrow jeans, long-legged, the ivory flats well-worn like slippers, the pink shirt, sleeves rolled. A thousand questions competed for Catherine's attention. When? For how long? How was it done? Why? The baby in the woman's arms was a boy with blue eyes. The hues were slightly different, though the difference was not as pronounced as it had been in his father's eyes. The envelope of time ripped open, and Catherine dropped in. She struggled not to have to lean against the door with the shock of the woman, of the boy's face. "Come in." The invitation broke the long note of silence that had passed between the two women. Although it was not an invitation at all, not in the way such offers are normally made, with a smile or a step backward into a hallway to allow entry. It was, rather, a statement, simple and without inflection, as though the woman had said instead, "Neither of us has a choice now." And the instinct was, of course, to enter the house, to get in out of the wet, to sit down. Catherine lowered the umbrella and collapsed it as she stepped over the door sill. The woman inside the house held the door with one hand, the baby with the other arm. The baby, perhaps having noted the silence, looked at the stranger with intense curiosity. A child in the hallway had stopped her playing to pay attention. Catherine allowed the umbrella to drip onto the polished parquet. In the several seconds the two women stood in the entryway, Catherine noticed the way the woman's hair swayed along her chin line, expertly cut, as Catherine's was not. She touched her own hair and regretted doing so. It was hot in the hallway, excessively hot and airless. Catherine could feel the perspiration trickling inside her blouse, which was under her suit coat, which was under her wool coat. "You're Mura Boland," Catherine said. The baby in Mura Boland's arms, despite the different sex, despite the slightly darker hair color, was precisely the baby that Maddie had been at that age. 5 months old, Catherine guessed. The realization created dissonance, a screeching in her ears, as though this woman she had never met were holding Catherine's child. Jack had had a son. The dark-haired woman turned and left the hallway for a sitting room, leaving Catherine to follow. The child in the hallway, a beautiful girl with enlarged pupils and a cupid mouth, picked up a handful of construction blocks, pressed them to her chest, and, eyeing Catherine the entire time, edged along the wall and entered the sitting room, moving closer to her mother's legs. The girl looked like her mother, whereas the boy, the son, resembled the father. Catherine put down the umbrella in a corner and walked from the entryway to the sitting room. Mura Boland stood with her back to the fireplace, waiting for her, although there had been no invitation to sit down, wouldn't be. The room had high ceilings and had been painted a lemon yellow. Ornately carved moldings were shiny with glossy white paint. At the front, the curved windows had long, gauzy curtains on French rods. Several low chairs of wrought iron, cushioned with oversized white pillows, had been placed around a carved wooden cocktail table, reminding Catherine of Arab rooms. Over the mantel behind the woman's head was a massive gold mirror, which reflected Catherine's image in the doorway so that, in essence, Catherine and Mira Boland stood in the same frame. On the mantel was a photograph in marquetry, a pinkish gold glass vase, a bronze figure. On either side of the bow window were tall bookcases. A carpet of muted grays and greens lay underfoot. The effect was of light and air, despite the grand architecture of the house, despite the dark of the weather. Catherine had to sit. She put a hand on a wooden chair just inside the doorway. She sat heavily, as though her legs had suddenly given out. She felt old, older than the woman in front of her who was nearly her own age. It was the baby, Catherine thought, that somehow testified to the newness of love, certainly to the relative proximity of sex. Or the jeans in contrast to Catherine's dark suit, or the way Catherine found herself sitting, her pocketbook primly in her lap. Beneath her coat, her right leg spasmed, as though she had just climbed a mountain. The baby began to fret, uttering small, impatient cries. Mira Boland bent to pick up a rubber pacifier from the cocktail table, put the nipple end in her own mouth, sucked it several times, and then put it into the baby's mouth. The boy wore navy corduroy overalls and a striped t-shirt. The dark-haired woman had full, even lips and wore no lipstick. Moving her eyes away from the woman with the baby, Catherine caught sight of the photograph on the mantel. When the picture came into focus, she started, nearly rose from her seat. The photograph was of Jack. She could see that even across the room. Unmistakable now from where she sat, cradling an infant, a newborn, his other hand ruffling the deep curls of another child, the girl who was in the room with them. In the picture, the girl had a solemn face. The trio appeared to be on a beach. Jack was smiling broadly. Visceral evidence of another life, although Catherine had needed no proof. "You're wearing a ring," Catherine said almost involuntarily. Muir fingered the gold band with her thumb. "You're married?" Catherine asked, disbelieving. "I was." Catherine was confused for a moment until she understood the meaning of the past tense. Muir shifted the baby to her other hip. "When?" Catherine asked. 4.5 years ago. The woman hardly moved her mouth when she spoke. The consonants and vowels rolled from her tongue with a distinctive melodic lilt. "Irish, then." "We were married in the Catholic Church," Muir volunteered. Catherine felt herself backing away from this information, as if from a blow. "And you knew?" she asked. "About you? Yes, of course." As though that were understood, that the dark-haired woman had known everything, whereas Catherine had not. Catherine put down her pocketbook, shook her arms free of her coat. The flat was overheated and Catherine was sweating profusely. She could feel the perspiration under her hair at the back of her neck. "What's his name?" Catherine asked, meaning the baby. She was astonished at her own politeness even as she asked the question. "Dermot," Mira said, "for my brother." The woman bent her head suddenly, kissed the baby's pate. "How old is he?" Catherine asked. 5 months, today. And Catherine thought at once, as who would not, that Jack might have been there, in that flat, to share the small milestone. The baby, pacified, appeared now to be falling asleep. Despite the revelations of the last several minutes, despite the unnatural relationship between herself and the baby, despite the very fact of the child's existence at all, Catherine felt an urge, akin to sexual, to hold the infant to her breast, to that hollow space that wants always to embrace a small child. The resemblance to Maddie at 5 months was uncanny. It might actually be Maddie. Catherine closed her eyes. Are you all right? Mira asked from across the room. Catherine opened her eyes, wiped her forehead with the sleeve of her jacket. I have thought, Mira began. I have wondered if you would come. When you called, I was sure that you knew. I was sure when he died, it would come out. I didn't know, Catherine said. Not really. Not until I saw the baby, just now. Or had she known, she wondered. Had she known from the moment she'd heard that transatlantic silence? There were shallow wrinkles about the eyes of the dark-haired woman, the suggestion of parentheses that would one day form at either side of her mouth. The baby woke suddenly and began to wail in an uninhibited, lusty way that had once been familiar to Catherine. Mira tried to comfort the child, bringing him to her shoulder, patting his back, but nothing seemed to work. Let me put him down, Mira said over the cries. When she left the room, the girl trailed after her, not willing to be left alone with a stranger. Jack had been married in a Catholic church. The dark-haired woman had known that he was already married. Catherine tried to stand, then felt she could not. She crossed her legs in an effort to look not quite so shaken, not quite so flattened. Slowly, she swiveled her head, trying to take in the entire room, the brass sconces with the electric candles on the walls, the magazines on the cocktail table, an oil painting of a working-class city street. She wondered why it was that she could not feel rage. It was as though she had been cut, the knife having gone so deep that the wound was not yet painful. It produced merely shock, and the shock seemed to be producing civility. Mira had known, had imagined this day. Catherine had not. Along one wall was a cabinet that Catherine guessed would contain a television and a sound system. She thought suddenly of Pink Panther movies, the ones she and Jack and Maddie had rented, movies guaranteed to reduce Jack and Maddie to helpless giggles. They had prided themselves on being able to quote long passages of dialogue. Catherine turned her head at a sound. Mira Boland stood in the doorway watching her from the side. She stepped into the room, crossed to one of the white chairs, and sat down. Immediately, she opened a wooden box on the cocktail table and took out a cigarette, which she lit with a plastic lighter next to the box. Jack couldn't tolerate being in the same room with a smoker, he had said. You want to know how it happened, Mira said. Though she was angular, she might be described as voluptuous. It was the baby, Catherine thought, the nursing. Perhaps there was just the slightest suggestion of a belly, which would also be the baby. Catherine had another unexpected memory then, a picture, really, that Jack had taken. Catherine was sleeping face down in a quilted bathrobe on an unmade bed, her arms tucked under her. Jack, who'd been holding the 5-month-old Maddie, had placed the sleeping baby, also face down, on the hump made by Catherine's butt and the dip of the lower back. Catherine and Maddie had together taken a nap, and Jack, moved by the side of the mother and her papoose, had snapped the photograph. Mira leaned back against a cushion, draped one arm along its back. She crossed her legs. Catherine thought she might be 6 feet tall, nearly as tall as Jack. Catherine tried to imagine what her body looked like unclothed, how she and Jack might look together. But her mind protested and rebelled, and the pictures refused to form, just as the image of Jack's body as it may have lain in the ocean had at first refused to form. The pictures would come later, Catherine knew, when she least wanted them. Yes, Catherine said. Mira took a pull on her cigarette, leaned forward, and flicked an ash. I flew with him 5.5 years ago, I was a flight attendant with vision. I know.
We fell in love, the woman said simply.
I won't go into all the details. I could say that we were both swept off our feet. We were together for a month that first time. We had... The woman hesitated, perhaps from delicacy, perhaps trying to find better words. We had an affair, she said finally. Jack was torn. He said he wouldn't leave Maddie. He could never do that to his daughter. The name Maddie produced a frisson in the air, a tension that quivered between the two women. Mira Boland had spoken the name too easily, as if she'd known the girl. Catherine thought, he wouldn't leave his daughter, but he could betray his wife. When was this exactly, Catherine asked, the affair? June 1991. Oh. What had she herself been doing in June of 1991, Catherine wondered. The woman had delicate white skin, an almost flawless complexion, the complexion of someone who spent little time outdoors. Though she might have been a runner. You knew about me, Catherine repeated. Her voice didn't seem her own. It was too slow and tentative, as if she had been drugged. I knew about you from the very beginning. Jack and I did not have secrets. The greater intimacy then, Catherine thought, an intentional knife wound. The rain slid along the bowed windows, the clouds giving a false sense of early evening. From an upstairs room, Catherine heard the distant squawk of a cartoon character on a television. Still perspiring, she shed her jacket and stood up, realizing as she did so that her blouse had become untucked. She made an effort to push it back into her skirt. Aware of the intense scrutiny of the woman across from her, a woman who may very well have known Jack better than she did, Catherine prayed her legs would not betray her. She walked across the room to the mantel. She took down the picture in its marquetry frame. Jack had on a shirt Catherine had never seen before, a faded black polo shirt. He cradled the tiny newborn. The girl, the one Catherine had just seen playing with the construction blocks, had Jack's curls and brow, though not his eyes. What's her name? Catherine asked.
Deirdre.
Jack's fingers were deep in the girl's hair. Had Jack been the same with Deirdre as he had been with Maddie? Catherine briefly closed her eyes. The hurt to herself, she thought, was nearly intolerable. But the hurt to Maddie was obscene. One could see, how could anyone fail to observe, that the girl in the photograph was extraordinarily beautiful. A beguiling face with dark eyes and long lashes, red lips, a veritable Snow White. Had memories that Maddie held sacred been repeated, relived with another child? How could you? Catherine cried, spinning, and she might have been speaking to Jack as well. Her finger, slippery from perspiration, lost hold of the frame. It slid out of her hands, crashed against an end table. She hadn't meant for that to happen, and she felt the small breakage as an exposure. The woman in the chair flinched slightly, though she did not turn her head to look at the damage. It was an unanswerable question. Though the woman wanted to answer it.
I loved him, Mira said. We were in love. As if that were enough.
Catherine watched as Mira put out her cigarette. How cool she was, thought Catherine, even cold.
There are things I can't talk about, Mira said.
You bitch, Catherine thought, a bubble of anger popping to the surface. She tried to calm herself down. It was hard to imagine the woman in the chair, a flight attendant in a uniform with little wings on the lapel, smiling at passengers as they entered a plane. What were the things Mira Boland couldn't talk about? She put her hands on the mantel, leaned her head forward.
She breathed in deeply to calm herself. A distant rage made a sound like white noise in her ears. She pushed herself away from the mantel and crossed the room. She perched near the edge of the wooden chair as if she might at any moment have to get up and leave. I was willing to do whatever it took, Mira Boland said. She fingered her hair away from her forehead. I tried once to throw him out, but I couldn't. Catherine folded her hands in her lap, considering this self-confessed lapse in character. The voluptuousness of the nursing, the slight suggestion of a belly, combined with the height, the angular shoulders, and the long arms, were arresting, undeniably attractive. How did you do it? Catherine asked. I mean, how did it work? Mira Boland raised her chin. We had so very little time together, she said. We did whatever we could. I'd pick him up at a prearranged spot near the crew apartment and bring him here. Sometimes we had only the night. At other times, again she hesitated. Jack would sometimes bid schedules in reverse, Mira said. Catherine heard the language of a pilot's wife. I don't understand, Catherine said quickly, though she thought sickeningly that she did. Occasionally, he would be able to arrange it so that his home base was in London, but of course that was risky. Catherine could remember the months Jack had seemed to have a terrible schedule. 5 days on, 2 days off, only the overnight at home. As you know, he didn't always get London, Mira continued. He sometimes had the Amsterdam-Nairobi route. I took a flat in Amsterdam during those times. He paid for this? Catherine asked suddenly, thinking, he took money from me, from Maddie. This is mine, Mira said, gesturing to the rooms. I inherited it from an aunt. I could sell it and move to the suburbs, but the thought of moving to the suburbs is somehow rather chilling. Catherine, of course, lived in what might be described as a suburb. He gave you money? Catherine persisted. Mira looked away as if sharing with Catherine for a moment the particular treachery of taking money from one family to give to the other. Occasionally, she said, I have some money of my own. Catherine speculated on the intensity of love that constant separation might engender, the intensity that being furtive and secret would naturally create. She brought her hand to her mouth, pressed her lips with her knuckles. Had her own love for Jack not been strong enough? Could she say that she had still been in love with her husband when he died? Had she taken him for granted? Worse, had Jack ever suggested to Mira Boland that Catherine hadn't loved him enough? She winced inwardly to think of that possibility. She drew a long breath and tried to sit up straighter. Where are you from? Catherine asked when she trusted her voice. Antrim. Catherine looked away. The poem, she thought, of course, here in the narrow passage and the pitiless north, perpetual betrayals. But you met here, Catherine said. You met Jack in London. We met in the air. Catherine glanced down at the carpet, imagining that airborne meeting. Where are you staying? Mira asked. Catherine looked at the woman and blinked. She could not recall the name of her hotel. Mira reached forward and took another cigarette from the box. The Kensington Exeter, Catherine said, remembering. If it makes you feel any better, I'm quite certain there was never anyone else. It did not make her feel any better. How would you know? Catherine asked. The outside light grew dimmer in the flat. Mira turned a lamp on and put a hand to the back of her neck. How did you find out? Mira asked. Discover us. Us, Catherine heard. She didn't want to answer the question. The search for clues seemed tawdry now. What happened on Jack's plane? Catherine asked instead. Mira shook her head and the silky hair swung.
I don't know, she said.
But there was, possibly, an evasive note in her voice, and she seemed noticeably more pale.
The suggestion of suicide is outrageous, she said, bending forward, putting her elbows on her knees, her head in her hands.
The smoke curled through her hair.
Jack would never, never.
Catherine was surprised by the woman's sudden passion, by a level of certainty she thought only she had felt. It was the only emotion the woman had shown since Catherine had entered the flat.
I envy you having had a service, Mira said, looking up. A priest. I would have liked to be there.
My God, Catherine thought.
I saw your photograph, Mira said, in the papers. The FBI is assembling its case?
So I'm told.
Do they talk to you?
No. Did they call you?
No, Mira said. You know Jack would never do this.
Of course I know that, Catherine said. After all, Catherine had been the first wife, the primary wife, had she not? But she wondered then, in a man's mind, who was the more important wife, the woman he sought to protect by not revealing the other, or the one to whom he told all his secrets? The last time you saw him, Catherine began.
That morning, about 4 a.m., just before he left for work, I woke up.
She left it there. You'd been out to dinner, Catherine said.
Yes,
Mira said, looking slightly surprised that Catherine knew this. She did not ask how. Catherine tried to remember if there had ever been an occasion when she had seriously suspected Jack of having an affair. She didn't think so. How devastatingly complete her trust in him had been.
You came here just for this? Mira asked, picking a stray sliver of tobacco from her lower lip.
She seemed to have recovered her composure.
Isn't that enough? Catherine asked.
Mira exhaled a long plume of smoke.
I meant, will you be traveling on to Malinhead? She asked.
No, said Catherine. Have you been?
I couldn't go, she said.
There was something more. Catherine could feel it.
What is it? Catherine asked.
The woman rubbed her forehead.
Nothing, she said, shaking her head lightly. We had an affair, she added, as if to explain what she had been thinking. I became pregnant and took a leave from the airline. Jack wanted to be married. It wasn't as important to me to be married. He wanted to be married in the Catholic Church.
He never went to church.
He was devout, Mira said and looked steadily at Catherine.
Then he was two different people, Catherine said incredulously. It was one thing to be married in a Catholic church because a lover wanted it, quite another to be devout oneself. Catherine intertwined her fingers, trying to steady them.
He went to Mass whenever he could, Mira said.
In Ely, Jack had never even entered a church. How could a man be two such different people? But then a new thought entered Catherine's mind, an unwelcome thought. Jack wouldn't always have been two different people, would he? As a lover, for example, mightn't some of the intimacies he shared with Catherine have been the same as those he shared with Mira Boland? If Catherine could bring herself to ask, wouldn't there be some recognition on the part of the woman sitting across from her? Or had there been an entirely other play, another script, different dialogue, unrecognizable props? Catherine unlinked her fingers, pressed her palms against her knees. Mira watched her intently. Perhaps she too was speculating. I have to use the bathroom, Catherine said, standing up abruptly, the way a drunk might do. Mira stood with her. It's just upstairs, she said. She led Catherine out of the sitting room and through the hallway. She stood at the bottom of the steps, gesturing with her hand. Catherine had to pass in front of her, and their bodies almost touched. Catherine felt diminished by the woman's height. The bathroom was claustrophobic and made Catherine's heart race. She glanced into the mirror and saw that her face had taken on a hectic flush and was mottled. She pulled the pins from her hair and shook it loose. She sat down on the toilet lid. A floral print on the walls made her dizzy. 4.5 years. Jack and Mira Boland had been married in a church 4.5 years ago. Perhaps guests had gone to the wedding. Had any of them known the truth? Had Jack hesitated when he said his vows? She shook her head roughly. Every thought bore with it a pictorial image Catherine didn't want to look at. That was the difficulty, allowing the questions, but holding back the images. Jack in a suit, kneeling in front of a priest. Jack opening a car door, slipping into the passenger seat. A small girl with dark curls hugging Jack's knees. In the distance, a phone rang. How, Catherine wondered, had Jack possibly managed it? The lies, the deception, the lack of sleep. One day, he had left Catherine and gone to work, and then, within hours, was standing in a church at his own wedding. What had Catherine and Maddie been doing on that day, at that precise hour? How had Jack been able to face them both when he came home? Had he made love to Catherine that night, the next night, that week? She shuddered to think of it. The questions bounced with tiny pings from wall to wall, repeating themselves endlessly. Then she remembered her stomach lurching, the twice-yearly training sessions in London, 2 weeks each. If you never suspected someone, she realized, you never thought to suspect. She stood up quickly, her eyes skittering around the tiny powder room. She splashed water on her face, dried it with an embroidered towel. She opened the bathroom door and saw across the hallway a queen-sized bed. From downstairs, Catherine could hear Mira talking on the telephone, the words rising and falling in her foreign lilt. If Jack had not been dead, she would perhaps not have had a right to enter the bedroom, but now nothing could matter. This house was hers to see. Knowledge of this house was owed to her. After all, Mira Boland had known all about her, hadn't she? Catherine ached to think of that reality. How many details exactly had Mira been told, and how intimate were those details? She walked through the doorway and thought of the effort she had made to please Jack, of the accommodations she had made for him, of the way she had created an entire theory of diminished sexual intimacy, of the way she had once confronted Jack with the fact of his withdrawal, and he had denied it, made it seem beneath his consideration, beneath hers. All of this she had thought normal, within the bounds of a normal marriage. She had, in fact, thought they had a good marriage. She'd told Robert they had had a good marriage. She felt foolish, exposed for a fool, and she wondered if she didn't mind that most of all. This would be the master bedroom. It was long and narrow, oddly messy, actually extraordinarily messy considering the neatness of the downstairs rooms. Piles of clothes and magazines were strewn about the floor. There were teacups and a container half full of yogurt on a bureau, ashtrays overflowing with butts, bottles of makeup on a dresser which was spotted with liquid foundation. One side of the wood-framed bed was not made. Catherine noted the expensive linen sheets, the embroidered hem. There were bits of lacy underwear on the comforter. The other side of the bed, still intact, had been Jack's. She could see this in the bedside stand with the white noise machine, the halogen lamp, a book about the Vietnam War. Had Jack read other books here than he had read at home? Had he had different clothes? Had he actually looked different in this house, in this country, than he had at home? Looked older or younger? Home, she thought. Now there was an interesting concept. She walked to Jack's side of the bed and yanked back the covers. She bent her head to the sheets and inhaled deeply. He was not there. She could not smell him. She crossed to the other side of the bed, Mira's side. On the bedside table, there was a small gold clock and a lamp. As if conducting a search, she opened the drawer of the table. Inside, there were scraps of papers, receipts, tubes of lipstick, a jar of skin cream, loose coins, several pens, a television clicker, an object in a velvet bag. Unthinkingly, Catherine picked up the bag and slipped off the blue velvet pouch. She dropped the object as if it were hot. She ought to have guessed simply from the shape. The vibrator fell from her hands and into the drawer with a clatter. She knelt to the floor, laid her face on the bed. She put her arms over her head. She wanted the questions to stop, and she tried to empty her mind, a futile effort. She rubbed her face back and forth against the sheet. She lifted up her face and saw that she had left a smear of mascara on the linen. She stood up and walked to the mirror-fronted wardrobe and opened the doors. The clothes were Mira's, not Jack's. Long black pants, wool skirts, cotton shirts, linen blouses, a fur coat. Her hand felt in her search what she thought was a silk blouse. Parting the hangers, she discovered that it was not a blouse but a robe, an ankle-length silk robe with a tasseled sash, an exceptional garment of deep sapphire. Trembling slightly, she lifted the neck of the robe away from the hanger and looked at the label. Bergdorf Goodman. She had known that it would be. She moved through the bedroom to the bathroom, noting everything, as if this were a house she might one day buy. On the hook by the tub was a man's maroon flannel robe. Jack had not worn a robe at home. Inside the medicine cabinet, she found a razor and a hairbrush. There was a bottle of English cologne that was not familiar to her. Inspecting the brush, Catherine found short, black hairs. She stared for a long time at the brush. She had seen enough. She wanted to get out of the house now. She shut the door to the master bedroom. Downstairs, she could still hear Mira Boland on the phone, the voice somewhat louder now, as though she might be arguing. Catherine passed the open door of the girl's room. Deirdre lay on the bed on her stomach, her chin in her hands, the same remarkably solemn expression on her face. She wore a long-sleeved blue t-shirt and a pair of overalls, blue ankle socks. So absorbed was the child in her program that at first she did not notice the stranger in her doorway. "Hello," Catherine said. The girl glanced in her direction, then turned on her side to contemplate this new person. "What are you watching?" Catherine asked. "Danger Mouse." "I've seen that. They used to show it in America. My daughter used to like Roadrunner, but she's bigger now. She's almost as tall as I am." "What's her name?" The girl sat up, more interested in the stranger. "Maddie." Deirdre considered